Welcome to New York Public Health Now podcast. This is where we talk about the why so you can decide what to do. I'm Dr. Jim McDonald, Commissioner of the New York State Department of Health. Again, sitting here in the 14th floor of Corning Tower overlooking Empire State Plaza here in downtown Albany. So as we continue in our second season of New York Public Health Now, today we have two guests to talk about measles. Two of our own in-house experts, Dr. Deb Blog, Medical Director of our Division of Vaccine Excellence here at the New York State Department of Health, and Travis O'Donnell, the Director of the Department's Center for Community Health. And before welcoming Dr. Blog and Travis, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Joanne Morin. Joanne, our Executive Deputy Commissioner. How are you today, Joanne?
I am doing great, and I'm really excited about today's guests and the conversation that we're going to have. So looking forward to sharing how New Yorkers can protect themselves against measles.
Yeah, it's kind of fun for me. We're going to talk a little bit about the Division of Vaccine Excellence, which is relatively new at the Department of Health. I'm going to talk a lot about measles today, too, which I think is a really, really important concept to talk about.
So let me introduce our guest. Dr. Deborah Blog began her public health career with the Bureau of Immunization at the department and was a director of the Division of Epidemiology. Before that, she worked for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on adult immunization and as a general pediatrician for 10 years.
And Travis O'Donnell is the director of the department's Center for Community Health, which is responsible for epidemiology, vaccination, chronic disease, nutrition, and family health activities throughout the state. Before serving this role, Travis worked for 20 years in sexual health and harm reduction, first in community-based organizations and later for the Department of Health. So welcome, Dr. Blog, and welcome, Travis.
Hi.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Let's just start off a little bit with you, Dr. Blog. I mean, we did an introduction, but you know, tell us a little bit more about yourself, please.
Well, as you said, I am a pediatrician. I did my first residency in pediatrics, and I worked for about 10 years as a general pediatrician. And I did a second residency in preventive medicine with the New York State Department of Health. And I've worked for the department for over 22 years, with a little bit of time at CDC. And I began my career in immunization, and I'm now back in immunization as the medical director. It's my favorite part of public health, and I really enjoy working in it.
Yeah, it's funny you remind me. I met you when I was doing my preventive medicine residency here at the New York State Department of Health, and it's interesting that we both have that in common. We're pediatricians and also did specialty training in preventive medicine, which I think preventive medicine is probably the least known medical specialty. It's my guess, but perhaps it should be the best known because ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is what the old saying goes here. So anyways, Dr. Blog, let's dive in a little bit to measles. So by late March of this year, 2024, 16 of our states had reported measles cases this year. At least that's data I have from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So Dr. Blog, let's just start. You know, can you just talk about what is measles and how is it spread?
Sure. Measles is an acute viral infectious disease. It's extremely contagious, and it spreads easily through the air when an infected person coughs or sneezes. It can cause severe disease complications and even death. It can affect anyone who is not immune, but it's most common in children. It infects the respiratory tract and spreads throughout the body. Symptoms include a high fever, cough, runny nose, and a rash that begins on the face and spreads downward on the body. And the best way to prevent it is through vaccination.
Very interesting. I want to talk a bit about, you know, you commented that measles are extremely contagious. Before we do that, though, and I'm going to turn to you, Travis, I just wanted to take a moment. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up here at the department.
Sure. Thanks, Joanne. So I'm Travis. I'm the director of the Center for Community Health at the New York State Department of Health. I've been in this position for about a year, and my path in public health, unlike Dr. Blog's, took a slightly more winding route. My educational background is in the liberal arts. I have a bachelor's degree in English, and I like to think my analytical skills are sort of give me that give me a springboard against which I can navigate large, complex systems and problems. I've got three kids, 9, 11, and 13, and I've been with the department for about 10 years, and it's just such an honor to come to work every day and work with such amazing, passionate, talented, educated experts like Dr. Blog and everyone else in the Center for Community Health.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. So let's go back to the conversation as it relates to some of the really prioritized work that you're both doing right now. I want to go back to this idea that measles are extremely contagious. So how do we compare the likelihood of infection to flu or COVID-19?
Yeah, thanks for that. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, measles is so contagious that if one person has measles, up to about 90% of the people who are not immune and who come in contact with that person will become infected. As I said, you can get measles through the air just by being in a room where a person infected with measles has been, or in an elevator, for example, even up to 2 hours after that person has left. Infected people can spread measles to others from 4 days before the rash, so before they even know they have it, perhaps, through 4 days after the rash appears. Compared to, say, flu or COVID, measles is much more infectious, about 4 to 6 times more infectious than flu or COVID. It's one of the most contagious diseases that we know of.
You know, Dr. Block, you remind me, measles used to be a common childhood disease. It doesn't have to be one again. I think in year 2000, measles was eliminated in the United States, but it's back here. And I was just thinking a little bit about how common it used to be and how rare it used to be and how we got rid of it and now it's back. But can you tell us, when was measles vaccine made available and how effective is the measles vaccine? Why don't we just talk a little bit about that?
Well, the measles vaccine was developed in 1963. And by the late 1960s, there were also vaccines available to protect against mumps and rubella. And these three vaccines were combined into the MMR vaccine in 1971.
Well, they've been around a long time, haven't they? These vaccines have been around for a long, long time, really.
Yeah, they've been around for quite a while. Before that, almost everybody got measles at one time in their life or another. One measles vaccine is about 93% effective against measles. And two are about 97% effective against measles.
Measles used to be a common childhood disease. So like pediatricians in the 40s and 50s would have all seen measles all the time. You know, I can tell you, I've been a pediatrician for 34 years. I've seen one case of measles in my career. And that was in medical school. And it was an adult before the second MMR vaccine was given. And I think the vast majority of physicians now actually don't have clinical experience. I haven't seen a case of measles because it just became so rare.
So I'm just thinking, before the measles vaccine was introduced, how frequently did major epidemics occur and what were the consequences of that? I ask because it seems as though years ago it was more commonplace to be diagnosed with measles.
That is correct. As I said, almost everybody got it in the pre-vaccine era. But there were also major epidemics that occurred about every 2 to 3 years. And there was an estimated 2.6 million deaths in the world each year. So very common and very dangerous.
Yeah, that 2.6 million deaths per year is stunning. You know, that old expression, if you don't learn from the past, you're doomed to repeat it?
Yes.
I do worry about that. And it's because I will tell you, like, being a pediatrician, I have attended, regrettably, the death of patients, rarely in my career, but it's just an awful, awful experience to be there when one of your patients passes away. It really is just awful. I want to shift our conversation a little bit to vaccine coverage in New York. It's quite frankly not what it should be. But is this a problem just in New York, or is it a problem in the United States or even around the planet? What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Block?
It isn't as high as it should be, and that's not just a problem in New York. It's a problem throughout the globe. In fact, the WHO recognized vaccine hesitancy as a major public health issue. People might not get vaccinated for a variety of reasons. It might be lack of access to health care. But increasingly, it's misinformation or disinformation about the vaccine safety or complacency from not having seen measles or lack of knowledge about disease risks. Low vaccination coverage can lead to outbreaks of disease like measles and other vaccine-preventable disease. So it's a global concern because diseases can easily spread across borders, especially in our connected world. And in addition, the COVID-19 pandemic increased the risk of measles outbreaks because Again, according to the CDC, over 61 million doses of measles-containing vaccines were postponed during the pandemic due to COVID-19-related delays in supplementary immunization activities in several countries. And this increases the risk of bigger outbreaks across the world, including in the United States.
Recognizing that, Travis, I have a question for you. How do we distribute the vaccine statewide? And is cost a barrier as far as getting access or coverage?
Sure. So there's actually a couple parts to this question, and we can approach it from whether you're insured or not insured. And for people who are insured, in general, your healthcare provider will commercially purchase the vaccine, administer it, and submit for reimbursement from a health insurance company. But we recognize that that doesn't work for everybody. And so the state has initiatives called Vaccines for Adults, or VFA, and Vaccines for Children, or VFC. And the way that these programs work, they're targeted for people who are uninsured or underinsured. And we have staff who work to enroll providers in the VFC or VFA programs, meaning they agree to all of our rules and will follow all storage requirements. And importantly, that they will serve people who are uninsured or underinsured. We will purchase the vaccine doses, and we'll obtain the vaccine doses that we've purchased specifically for the program. And then the enrolled providers will order the vaccine through a centralized distributor, and then the doses will go to the healthcare provider. So our networks for these VFA and VFC programs are fairly robust, but there's always room for improvement, recognizing that we need to do everything we can to expand these programs so that nobody goes without. As far as your question about cost should never be a barrier. In the Department of Health and in CCH, health equity really is our lodestar. And so we work to make sure that these options are available for people who can't afford to pay out of pocket for a vaccine. Most local health departments, as well as over 80 federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs, are enrolled in the Vaccines for Adults program. You know, but I recognize that this really just sort of covers the out-of-pocket cost of the vaccine itself. I think as a society, we need to do more to ensure that people have access to transportation, have access to childcare, recognizing that there is an impact on somebody's bottom line beyond just paying for the cost of the dose itself.
Yeah, thanks, Travis. That was great. So Dr. Blagg, why don't we talk a bit about vaccine hesitancy? You know, this was something that was on the rise even before the pandemic. But can you just talk a little bit about the mission of the Division of Vaccine Excellence, relatively new here at the Department of Health, and how do we plan to address vaccine hesitancy here at the Department of Health? What is our strategy for that?
The mission of the Division of Vaccine Excellence, or DOVE, is the promotion of vaccine throughout the lifespan. And we have what we consider more routine activities like the Vaccines for Children program, the Vaccines for Adults program, vaccine preventable disease surveillance, school vaccine issues. A major part of our mission now is addressing vaccine hesitancy. And we plan to form a bureau that is dedicated to vaccine education and addressing hesitancy. We plan to use the latest in research methods. We plan to involve behavioral scientists and others who can help us and support us in this to address vaccine hesitancy in New York State. I think it's extremely important that we do so. It's extremely timely, and we can't afford to not address it and be left behind in that regard.
Yeah, and let me just follow up on that. You know, it's interesting. The measles, mumps, umbrella vaccine, as you said before, it's been around a long time. You know, I can't tell you how many kids in my career have given the vaccine to. It's many. It's a really safe vaccine. I mean, the most common side effect I saw from the measles vaccine in particular was maybe about 1 out of 20 kids would get a fever and a rash, you know, 3-5 days later. And that fever and rash is just because it's a live vaccine. But there's a lot of myths about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. You know, autism is one of those things where it's an issue. It's near and dear to my heart because I have 3 kids. 2 of them have different forms of autism. And by the way, I think one of the things about being a parent of 2 kids with autism and a pediatrician who's taking care of, I don't know how many kids with autism is, every kid I've taken care of with autism is a little bit different. They're all very different. But there's really no evidence that links any vaccine to autism in the scientific community, but it's part of the lay understanding a little bit. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind? Like, what is that connection all about? And any ideas on how to dispel people of that?
Yeah, I think that misconception has been around for a long time. I think it took off when Dr. Andrew Wakefield published a study about the connecting autism and the MMR vaccine. His study was disproven, and the journal that published it retracted it. He lost his license in England and has not been able to practice in this country either. And there's been large-scale studies that have looked at children who have autism versus those who do not, and the incidence of obtaining MMR vaccine, and it has been shown that there is no difference, and there is no connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. But yet it persists, and it's very hard to fight those notions.
Right. Travis, I have a question for you. So we know that New York State had a measles outbreak. That was in 2018 and 2019. What are the lessons that we've learned from that experience that, you know, we're looking to apply should we find ourselves in a situation again? And what are some of the challenges that the department faces as we navigate a potential measles outbreak?
Sure. I think first and foremost, as Dr. Blog just alluded to, you know, the low vaccination rates still persist here in the country as well as here in New York State. In several communities, and these low vaccination rates really make people vulnerable to vaccine preventable diseases such as measles. I think furthermore, working with our local health department partners and directly with the communities most impacted is really important. It's truly a team effort to lead a measles response or a response to any outbreak. I think that, as we saw in the COVID pandemic as well, you know, working with communities is truly a year-long process as well. We hear all the time that we can't just show up when we need something from community. We have to form strategies and resource those strategies such that we're able to engage in meaningful, ongoing dialogue with the communities most impacted. I think also we have an upward battle as far as a combating anti-vaccine messages goes. They have a real documented detrimental effect on vaccine rates. And right now, when you look at vaccine uptake over time, you note a consistent downward trend. And we are going to need to take real meaningful action over an extended period of time to climb back to where we were so that we can talk about measles elimination once again.
Travis, you talked earlier about the Vaccine for Children program. What is the Vaccine for Children program?
It is a program that is funded by federal and state dollars that supports uninsured or underinsured children to make sure that they can get any vaccine recommended by ACIP to ensure that cost is never a barrier for any child to get their vaccines.
Travis, you mentioned ACIP. Who is ACIP?
ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and it is a panel of subject matter experts and physicians who, on an ongoing basis, evaluates all the evidence about vaccine efficacy and vaccine safety. And they set the bar for what immunizations should be recommended for all children based on that evidence.
Dr. Blug, I have another question. So as we see measles cases starting to climb or increase in the United States and around the world, how common is it for an individual who is infected with measles to actually require hospitalization?
Well, the complications of measles, including otitis media or ear infections, pneumonia, and diarrhea, occur commonly in young children, pregnant women, and adults over 20 years of age, and also in immunocompromised hosts. In general, about 1 in 4 people who get measles will be hospitalized. Acute encephalitis, or inflammation of the brain, which often results in permanent brain damage, occurs in approximately 1 in every 1,000 cases. And 1 or 2 people out of 1,000 will die, even with the best care. Another scary sequela of measles is something called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is a long name for a rare neurodegenerative disease that occurs 7 to 10 years after the measles infection. So it can be a very serious disease.
You know, Dr. Blog, I think about the subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. It's really, really rare, but it, you know, it occurs 7 to 10 years after, and there's really no treatment for that. But when someone has measles, can you talk a little bit about how their immune system works after they have measles? Like, in other words, when you have measles, do you just get better, or is there any consequences for your immune system in the short term?
Well, it's interesting. There is an increasing evidence that the immune system does not function normally after measles infections. And I think we are learning more and more about that. But children who get measles may be more vulnerable to other infectious diseases for a period after having measles.
You've both given us a tremendous amount of information in the last few minutes that we've been together, but what haven't we asked? What else would you like to tell us and make sure that others who are listening to our podcast know?
Well, I think one thing I would share is, you know, right now I feel like the department has been on sort of tenterhooks with respect to the potential for another measles outbreak. We lived through one not too long ago, 2019. Dr. Blog was at the forefront of that, so the memory is fresh in her mind. Right now, we have fewer than 10 cases in the state, which is good news, and the majority of those have been travel-related, meaning somebody has sort of brought measles into the country. We do have one case outside of New York City, and the local health department, in this case, Nassau, has done a tremendous response. And, you know, I do think that we have painted a somewhat gloomy picture of measles here for understandable reasons, but the good news is we really do have the best team here at the State Department of Health and with the local health department. We have Dove, the Division of Vaccine Excellence. We didn't have that last time we went through this. And I really think that, you know, I've been with the department 10 years, and we are not an ivory tower health department. We are people who have had boots on the ground, who survived the COVID pandemic, survived the measles pandemic. And if there's one thing this department does well, it's really come together in order to mount an effective public health response. And that's what we're seeing right now with measles in New York State.
Yeah, thanks, Travis. And Dr. Blog, just to kind of end on this note of a little bit, like the vaccines we give as pediatricians are approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And many of them have been around for a very long time, as you mentioned with the measles vaccine in particular. It's been around as long as I have. But can you talk a little bit about what is the approval process look like to get a vaccine approved? Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. There is an extensive process involved with vaccine trials that go through the phases that we may or may not be familiar with. There's phase one, phase two, and phase three. And it even starts before that in the lab, looking at vaccine use in animals. But when we get to phase one is a small trial, and then they get bigger in phase two and phase three. And even beyond that, there is an extensive monitoring system for vaccine safety. It's something that is taken extremely seriously. And there's a number of systems that look at vaccine safety in certain populations. There is the ability to report vaccine-associated events so that they can be investigated. I honestly think there is not a medical intervention that is as carefully studied as vaccines are.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Even the post-marketing surveillance continues every single day.
It sure does.
Well, thank you both for joining us. You know, we talk about the why, help people decide what to do. When I think about the why of measles is, why is it still a disease we're dealing with? It was eliminated, and I think it's why, because it's a really contagious disease. Until it's eliminated globally, we're going to be dealing with it. Best way to eliminate it globally is just eliminate the spread, and that's done through immunizations with FDA-approved vaccines. So really fun to have you both, Travis and Dr. Blog. Dr. Blog, thank you very much.
Thank you. This is fun.
Travis, it was good to have you. Thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So that's going to do it for today's episode of New York Public Health Now podcast. As always, if there's a topic of interest you'd like to hear us talk about, let us know by email at publichealthnowpodcast@health.ny.gov. Please keep an eye out for the latest New York Public Health Now episode on your favorite podcast player like Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, YouTube, and Google Podcasts. Search by our podcast title, New York Public Health Now, or by keyword NYSDOH. Then tap the follow or subscribe button to be notified when we release a new episode, which is about every other week. For New York Public Health Now podcast, I'm Dr. Jim McDonald.
I'm Joanne Morin.
I'm Travis O'Donnell.
I'm Deborah Blog.
Thank you for listening.
New York Public Health Now is a production of New York State Department of Health's Public Affairs Group. Michael Wren is the executive producer and engineer, with additional production support provided by Sarah Snyder, Janine Babakian, Barbara Stubblebine, Alicia Biggs, Monica Pomeroy, and Kyle Kotary. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at publichealthnowpodcast@health.ny.gov.